Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Hits the streets today. We are live at the Pine downtown, 109th and Jasper. Drop by and say hello to us. We're here until 2 o'clock today talking Edmonton Oilers, past, present, and future, plus the NHL's biggest stories every week. And you can email us, by the way, at nationradio@theteam1260.com. Very busy show today. Our guests will include David Staples from the Edmonton Journal. We'll be talking to him about advanced stats. He has something called The Error. We'll talk a little bit about. We'll get an arena update from David as well and talk a little bit about the Edmonton Oilers moving forward. Jonathan Willis from OilersNation.com. He had three very interesting articles on the Oilers this year, including this week, including Colton Tubert and a couple on the draft. And we'll drop by with Jonathan as well. In the second hour, Jeff Crischel from Crush Health Show. It comes on at 5 o'clock today and also on Thursday night on Team 1260 Radio. Here's a guy who can talk to us a little bit about the Sam Gagner injury. He can tell us about the Taylor Hall situation and as well, We'll talk a long time about concussions because that seems to be the item on the NHL slate this week with the meetings coming. I think Monday they start, and there's 3 days worth of meetings with the head honchos in the National Hockey League. So that's something we'll get into. Kurt Ludicky will join us from Bruins Draft Watch. He was on earlier this morning with the Pipeline guys, and we'll talk to him as well about the Sedano Chara situation, about the 2011 draft. He has a fabulous blog that he updates every day. And later on in the show, we'll talk to Oklahoma City's Barron's play-by-play announcer Jim Beyer. Their life and death for the playoffs. A big win last night. One of the major stars in that game was Timo Hartikainen. So we'll talk to him about the playoff opportunity and then maybe a little more about what's coming down the pipe for the Edmonton Oilers, and Timo Hartikainen will be a big part of that story as well. Our first guest was slated to be E.J. McGuire today. E.J. is the Central Scouting bigwig, but he had double booked, so we're going to invite E.J. to join us next Saturday. And I want to thank everybody who emailed us questions. We probably had 35 or 40 questions for E.J., so we're going to have to extend the show anyway, or extend a segment to two segments with him. That didn't happen today. We'll do it next Saturday. And with that happening, the opportunity arose for us to sit down and talk to Guy Flaming, who just ended his show. And I'm wondering, do we have Guy on the line yet?
I'm here, Al.
Oh, good. I appreciate you. You get so little airtime on Team 1260. I really appreciate you spending a few moments with us here.
Hey, no problem, Al. My pleasure.
Want to begin with, you covered the Edmonton Oilers and the minor leagues and the draft early on in your time with Coming Down the Pipe. And a lot of that was Oiler talk. And Devan Dubnyk was drafted in 04. I know you followed him very closely with his WHL career, mm-hmm. and then when he turned pro. And I wanted to talk about his play last night and then maybe get into a little bit about how he's been handled compared to Jeff Drouin Delorier and how he was handled when he turned pro by the Edmonton Oilers. First, let's talk about Dubnyk and his development.
Well, I think certainly he's got more opportunity, or he's had more opportunity than Jeff Delorier did when Delorier turned pro. I mean, how many different jerseys has Jeff Delorier worn over the last 4 or 5 years in his pro career? When you go back, and he played for the Edmonton Roadrunners, and he was in with the Columbus Cottonmouths and the Greenville Growl and all of those teams. And Devan Dubnyk's basically had Stockton and the AHL affiliate, whether it was Springfield or Oklahoma City, and now with the Oilers. So I think it's been a much more normal path for Devan Dubnyk. And I think that bodes well for development, certainly compared to what Jeff Delorier has had to go through, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Delorier is a UFA this summer. Dubnyk is signed for another year at a really good price. Mm-hmm. Do you see the Oilers parting ways with Delorier?
I wouldn't be surprised because they can't get rid of Nikolai Habibulin, I wouldn't think, so they're going to need that goalie spot. And whether they bring back Martin Gerber or not, I think a lot of people would like to see them do that, whether Martin Gerber wants to come back with just an AHL contract or not. If he can get a better priced one-way deal out of the Oilers, maybe that'll work out for him. But I don't see Brian Pitton coming being re-signed. So the Oilers, I guess Olivier Waugh could turn pro, and maybe he does, and that takes up one of their farm team spots. But I still think that Jeff Delorier, he's been very professional about it ever since, he's been around in Edmonton, and we've been able to talk to him face-to-face. He's always been really, really professional about the way he's been handled, and I think internally he has to have been really frustrated over the last 4 or 5 years, and I think it would be beneficial for him to get a new start, change of scenery. You know, some of those guys, just that's all they need to get their career kick-started again. I think he's probably one of those guys.
So my next question, is he a guy like Tim Thomas, who the Oilers had, I think, in Hamilton in the late 90s,
yeah,
who maybe has to go to Europe and sort of have everybody forget about him and then impress at another level?
Yeah, whether it's Europe or just another NHL franchise, I think just a change of scenery and would do Jeff DeLoury wonders to get his career back on track.
In your show today, and you touched on it, and if I missed some of it, I apologize. We might be going over some covered ground here. But in your show today, you guys talked about the number of kids who are able to turn pro this fall.
Mm-hmm.
The Curtis Hamilton, Ryan Martindale, a lot of the guys who were drafted just a year ago are eligible. Do you see any of the? I see Martindale as being a guy who probably doesn't have much more to learn at the OHL level, especially with those outstanding wingers of his. So he's a likely guy who's going to turn pro. Do you see any of them staying back for their what would be their 20-year-old season in junior?
I honestly don't. I think all of those guys will turn pro, and you know, I think Cam Abney probably plays in Stockton, and maybe Martindale does too, but you know, I think Pitlick makes that jump. Martin Marincin out of PG, I think, will certainly go down and play in Oklahoma City, and so I don't expect any of the guys that are eligible, I don't think they'll hold back any of them. Maybe Brandon Davidson, and I only say that because this is only his second year in the WHL after playing in the AJ, so I could see where you could make an argument to suggest that maybe another year in the WHL wouldn't necessarily slow his development at all. So of the guys that are eligible, I think he's probably the one that might be the most likely to stay another year playing junior.
The RFAs this summer who are playing in OKC right now are Stortini, O'Mara, Marquardt, Montgomery, who they just acquired, Brian Pitton, the goalie, and Jordan Benfield. Of that group, who do you see possibly the Oilers cutting ties with?
I would say Stortini is probably a guy they trade if they can. I don't know if you would just cut him loose.
No, he has value, I think.
Yeah, I would think so, too. So I could see them re-signing him and trying to trade him, and if they can't, then re-signing him. But Marquardt, I think you can certainly walk away from that one. I don't expect Brian Pitton to get re-signed or Jordan Benfield either. So I would think Ryan O'Mara has probably still got some value. And, hey, you and I both think that he's, you know, a potential fourth liner at the NHL level. So, and Kevin Montgomery, I don't see any reason why you just acquired the guy, why you wouldn't sign him. So I certainly expect he gets a contract.
What does it mean for guys who have struggled or not played as much for the Barons, like Johan Motin or a guy who struggled like Chris Vandeveld? Is it possible they would buy them out or ship them away at less of a cost?
I would be surprised if they were to buy out guys like that. I mean, you use a draft pick on him. You just brought Motin over. I'm sure you want to give him some time to develop. And Chris Vandeveld, this is a guy that they were really high on in his draft year. And it's been 4 full years in North Dakota. It's developing. This is his first pro year and might be playing down the depth chart. But so did Kyle Brodziak in his first year when the Roadrunners were here in Edmonton. So I don't see any reason why the Oilers would walk away from either one of those guys.
What about a guy like Rahala? Does he get kept back in Europe because of the depth they're going to have in pro hockey here?
I'd be surprised if Tony Rahala didn't come over. And I think Anton Lander's in that same boat. I think both of those guys come over. The difference, I think Lander has a legitimate shot at cracking the NHL roster. I think Tony Rahala might be a guy that he might even start in the ECHL. I think he's more of a long shot, but I wouldn't be surprised if he came over. Although, that said, if it looks like it's ECHL for him, he might just stay in Finland for another year, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing either. The Oilers still retain his rights. So I think they have some options there with Rahala. So, but with Anton Lander, I think that's an interesting one to follow, especially if he comes over.
Is there a possibility that he signs before the end of this season and plays with the Barons, or is that out?
No, I suppose that's a possibility. I don't know how likely that is, and how long has he been done now for? I think it's 2 or 3 weeks, I think, since his Swedish Elite team has been done. So I'm not sure if they're negotiating that with him right now or not.
I know they've signed Taylor Fadun, but has he played down there?
I do not have Oklahoma's roster in front of me, so I'm not sure if he is dressed or not. I know he was expected to join them earlier this week, so I imagine he's there. Whether he has played a game or not yet, I don't know. I know that defense is pretty thick as it is right now, especially after getting Montgomery and Tubert. They clogged up that the blue line back there for the Barons earlier this weekend at the trade deadline. So I'm not sure necessarily if Fedun has played yet or not. I could pull it up, but I'm sure.
That's okay. I think he might be a guy who ends up practicing with the team, but maybe not playing with them. Tell me a little bit about him. I know I read a really interesting article you had on Coming Down the Pipe, and he's maybe the smartest guy in a pretty smart organization of hockey players.
Who is that, Soriel?
Fedun.
Yeah, Taylor Fedun. Well, certainly. I mean, this is a guy that's basically a rocket scientist coming out of Princeton. So, yeah, absolutely. The IQ level of the organization just went through the roof, I think. Millard is still here in the studio, and he just wrote me a note reminding me, hey, Anton Lanner could play in the World Championships for Sweden.
That's true, too. That's a good point.
Certainly makes a lot of sense.
Well, he's not just a pretty face, then.
Who, Millard? Yeah. No. Hair and teeth, as he says.
So Fedun, he's a puck-moving defenseman, right?
Yeah, kind of a two-way guy, and I think when in his draft year, there was some questions about his foot speed, and he was still a fairly gangly kid. He had the size or the height, but he hadn't filled out yet. Now he's 6'1 and 210, so I think there's no concerns about whether or not he can play physically, and I think that's part of the strong part of his game. More of a two-way guy, but I think a little bit more defensive at the pro level than he was as a collegian. I think he put up some points there, but the ECAC, traditionally a fairly weak conference compared to the other college conferences, so there might be a little bit of inflation point-wise there.
This is Nation Radio, live at the Pint on Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260, 109th and Jasper, in conversation with Guy Flaming from Coming Down the Pipe and the Pipeline Show. You are the guy I always listen to for the NCAA information, but in Lou We Trust is a really good blog, and they had an item from Tom Stavali about the 2011 NCAA free agent watch, and one of them was the kid that Edmonton just signed for Fedun. On that list is a guy named Che Genoway, and I know you know a lot about him as well.
Yeah.
Would he be on the Oilers' radar or no?
Tough to say. A defenseman out of North Dakota. He's been banged up. He missed most of last year, so he was able to come back and get another year to play college hockey again. But he's been banged up again this year, so I'm not sure. There are a lot of people who thought he could be a Hobie Baker contender at the start of the season, but injuries has really taken him out of that picture. Che Genoway, he's a good player, and I'm sure there are teams that are going to be, you know, interested in maybe not just signing him directly, but inviting him to a camp if he's still a free agent and having a closer look at him in that regard. I don't know if the Oilers are one of those teams, though.
Is there anybody else out there that you know of that's a free agent and not draft eligible that Edmonton might look at based on their tendency to sign big brains and maybe going for a little more size than they have in the past?
Well, I know there are some players at Merrimack College that Jesse Todd was the guy they invited to their prospect camp a couple years ago. So he might still be on their radar, and there's a defenseman there named Carl Stollery. And, of course, Kyle Bigos plays there, and he's a prospect of theirs. But if you're looking for free agents, Stollery might be a guy. And there's a Frenchman who seems to be one of the most valued potential free agent signings out of the NCAA this offseason. His name is Stéphane DeCoste. He played in the USHL, but he comes from Paris, France, and he's been lighting up the NCAA over the last couple seasons. So those would be some guys to watch for.
Paris, France, I think there's been like two guys in history from France, right? Like that's a...
Well, Cristobal Huet is for sure. I can't off the top of my head think of another one. Do you?
There's some guy from the 70s, and I can't remember his name, but I know he played for the Islanders, and he was a center, and he had a long last name. How many times have you seen Ryan Nugent-Hopkins?
Six or seven times there. He'll be here again in the next 10 days and gone down to Red Deer two or three times as well to watch there and saw a lot online and stuff. And I'm not necessarily a guy who believes you can get a full picture of a guy watching online, but it helps. And, of course, saw him at the World Junior Camp, things like that, and talked to a lot of people who follow him. That's probably the biggest thing. He's definitely a player of interest for sure, as everyone knows, as the 2011 draft gets closer. But he's definitely a talented player.
I think he's the most dynamic of the top-end guys, the four people that we talk about, Larson, Couturier, and Nugent Hopkins, and Landeskog. He appears to have that terrific skill set that makes you jump out of your seat.
Well, it certainly does. And, you know, this is something Dean and I were talking about on the Pipeline Show last week. There's a lot of people who say, well, he's too small. Why would you draft another small guy? The Oilers have too many small forwards. And, you know, and that's the way I've felt for most of the season. And now I've just come to the conclusion, if he's the best player available, draft him and trade your other small forwards if you're the Oilers. You know, if he's going to be the best small forward on your team, he's better than Sam Gagner, he's better than Cogliano. Or Liam Reddick's obviously is, you know, pales in comparison. So if you draft Ryan Nugent-Hopkins because he's the best player available, do it. and trade the other guys that you have on your team that make you too small.
Well, and he's not small either. It's just that he's thin, right? He's rail thin. He's like 6'1 and 170 or something. So he could grow into that body. I don't see Gagne and Nugent Hopkins being able to play on the same team unless they would move Gagne to wing. Is that a possibility?
I don't know if Gagne's fast enough to play the wing, for me, at least. I don't know if you're looking at Sam Gagne to be any more than a second-line center, and I don't think he's a second-line center on a contending team. So I think Sam Gagne is a pretty good trading asset. I think that the most value he has to the Oilers organization maybe moving forward is what he can bring you back in a trade. So I agree with you, though. I don't think the Oilers could be a team that has Nugent Hopkins and Gagne and Cogliano and all the other small guys. And we mentioned he's not necessarily small, Ryan Nugent Hopkins, small vertically, but very slight. He's a lot like Kyle Turris was in his draft year and Mason Raymond. I don't think he's quite as tall as those guys, though. You said he's 6'1". I don't think he's a whole lot more than 6.
Okay.
We're splitting hairs, though, because that's like an inch.
And also, we're in a town where Gretzky played, so, it can be done, right?
Sure.
Couturier is a guy that I like because he's that big center we haven't had since the 60s. Not really, but it's been a long time. He's a big guy, but he seems to be moving down the charts. Every time I look at a rating for the draft, he's 5 or 6 now as opposed to 2 or 3.
Yeah.
Is it speed or is it lack of toughness? What's the reason Couturier is going backwards?
Well, I think part of it is the performance of some of the other guys. But, yeah, he's, we had Sam Cosentino on the show on Tuesday, who joins us every week on the Pipeline Show, and he mentioned that, in the last viewing, the last game that they had on Sportsnet, he was really complaining a lot to the refs, and I think that turned some guys off. And I'm not sure if that's something that would contribute to a big drop in the rankings, but you're right. This is a big forward. Maybe the last big center that the Oilers had is probably Jason Arnott. I don't know if he has better potential or less offensive potential than Arnott, but I mean, that's, if they're even close, that's a pretty good pickup right there. And I think Couturier, he didn't perform. He wasn't lights out at the World Junior, but you got to keep in mind he was 17. And, in the queue, he keeps racking up points there. He was the leading scorer in the league last year and probably would have been this year if not for missing a lot of time with the World Junior. So I think Sean Couturier would be a wise pickup for anybody, whether he's the Oilers guy or not. I mean, they could go with Adam Larson. They could go with Gabriel Landeskog as well. And I think there's another guy that might be in the mix as well. But
who's that, Ryan Strome?
Yeah, Ryan Strome is a name that I'm hearing more and more about as the draft gets closer. I don't know that they would have him ahead of those other four guys, but if they happen to be picking second or third and their number one guy is gone, Ryan Strome, I think, might be a guy that's in the mix.
Okay, a couple of quick ones because we're running out of time. If you're the Oilers and you draft, let's just say you draft Couturier with the first overall pick, and then you're at about 9 and your pick is 20, and you want to move up because somebody like Dougie Hamilton is still available, do you think the Oilers might do something major like trade a Hamsky or a Gagne plus the 20 to move up? Is that the kind of player they might get at 9 this year?
Well, I think Dougie Hamilton will be gone before 9, but there are other defensemen in the draft that I think might be worth trading up for, Duncan Siemens, and I know Josh Morrow is a guy that a lot of people like, Joe Morrow, excuse me, out of Portland. And although personally, I think the Oilers would have their eye on a guy like David Musil, who I think you can still get where the LA Kings pick is going to be. I don't think you would have to trade up to get him, but I know David Musil is a guy that the Oilers have their eye on, too.
So you think that they would, even after having acquired Tubert, they'd go get a stay-at-home type in the first round?
It's quite possible. I mean, there's no guarantee Colton Tubert is going to play in the NHL, so I think you're just picking up more future assets. And Kevin Lowe's always been a guy who said, until they're playing for you in the NHL, that's all they are is assets.
Okay. One final question, and this is way off topic, but I keep meaning to ask you this. I've had conversations with some folks about the United States Hockey League, and a few years ago it was considered to be well below the CHL, each of the three CHL leagues.
Yep.
It is improving, but it's not at that level yet, right? When we see a kid out of the USHL and he's got, mind-boggling numbers, it's still not at the level of an ECHL league.
I would agree with that. I would say it's better than Junior A in Canada, but not as good as Major Junior. I think if you were, the World Junior A Challenge goes every year, and that's you'll see an all-star team come out of the USHL, and they'll play an all-star team from Western Canada, Junior A, and the East. and the Americans have won the last, I believe it's 3 years in a row. So I think they're better than the junior A system in Canada right now, or at least the level of players, but not up to par with the world with the major juniors. They have added the U.S. National Development Program in that league, so I mean that's going to inflate their draft numbers coming out of that league. But you go back to 2000, the Jeff Petrie year. I want to say it was 2006.
Yeah.
And Des Moines had, you know, Trevor Lewis and Kyle Oposo and Jeff Petrie, all three of those guys playing for Des Moines in the USHL, all taken in the top 45. So, I mean, that was a banner year. I think the USHL is definitely a league on the rise, and they keep expanding, so it's getting higher profile, too.
Guy, I owe you lunch now, but you'll never collect.
That's true.
Okay, thanks, buddy.
All right, see y'all.
All right, Guy Flaming from coming down the pipe, and of course, the Pipeline Show on Team 1260. You hear him every, well, a couple times a week on Team 1260 Radio. This is Nation Radio, live at the Pint today, 109th and Jasper. Drop by and say hello to us, and you can also email us at nationradio@team1260.com. Coming up after the break, David Staples from the Edmonton Journal.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
We are live today at the Pint, 109th and Jasper, Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260. Our email, nationradio@team1260.com. We're here until 2 o'clock today. Big week for the Pint. They have the, it's St. Paddy's Day, right, Troy, that they're opening up the new Pint down on White Avenue, where the old Purple Onion was? Okay. All right. I even know where that is. We got an email here from Jono. Want your opinion on the Barons. They're in a real fight to get into the playoffs. It looks like Teemu Hartikainen is really coming on strong. Big physical, willingly scores below the hash marks as well. Don't look now, but Chris Vandeveld seems to be keeping his head above water. And I've heard some astronomical face-off numbers anywhere those stats are held. No, actually, I've looked forever for time on ice and face-off numbers for the AHL, and they don't. I know that they. It's weird because I believe that they have them. They just don't share them, and the same as in the WHL. Some WHL rinks keep all that information. It's not released. Shots on goal, time on ice, face-offs, but it's not released to the general public, which is a pet peeve of mine. But what are you going to do, right? Hopefully someday we'll have that information because it is really, really valuable stuff. I've been waiting for this opportunity for quite some time now because David Staples and the Edmonton Journal have really done a masterful job of making their website and the Cult of Hockey a must-stop every day for Edmonton Oilers fans. David, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Alan. How are you doing?
Very well. I know some of the things that you've done because I've been dropping by Cult of Hockey for a few years now, but you really have done a splendid job of really adding writers like Bruce McCurdy and yourself and making some really interesting inroads for fans of the Edmonton Oilers and the prospects.
You know, we've been kind of part of what's been going on the blogosphere for a few years now. And really, it was Dennis King of MC79 who's argued the longest that I know of for following scoring chances, and he's been doing it for 3 years. And that's kind of the latest thing we've been doing, and I think the most interesting thing is, you know, we track the scoring chances for and against the Oilers, and I also break down the videotape of each scoring chance and try to figure out who's involved in each one. So in the end, you get kind of an individual scoring chance number, like for Taylor Hall, for instance, you might see he's created 300 scoring chances at even strength, and he's made mistakes on about, I think it's about 100 of them. So he's plus 200 when it comes to scoring chances this year. So that's what that's been the main focus of the blog this year.
And it's very interesting information. I hope one day that the entire National Hockey League adopts a similar, or at least, you know, maybe the blogosphere adopts a similar idea for all 30 teams, because I think it would be very interesting to compare someone like Taylor Hall to someone like Jeff Skinner, for instance, to see what kind of difference there is in who's running the show and who's doing what on the ice. Would you agree with that?
I'd love to know that kind of information for players on other teams. And you know, I'd really be interested in see at the center ice position, because Horkoff has excellent numbers when it comes to scoring chances, plus minus. He probably creates three for every one that he gives up, whereas Cogliano and Gagne don't do very well. Cogliano's kind of in the middle. He creates two for every one he gives up, and then Gagne, it's like almost maybe three he creates for two that he gives up. So mm-hmm. There's quite a different ratio for the three centers. And I'd really be curious to see how that would rank with other players in the league. And, you know, we don't have league-wide scoring chance data yet. I think most NHL teams keep their own scoring chance data, so that'll be the first thing, is I think that the NHL will make that number official down the road sometime. And then to do the kind of work we're doing where you actually break down the play, I know NHL teams have done it in the past. The New York Rangers did it in the 90s, Billy Moores was telling me. He used to do a similar thing, breaking down offensive plays at least, with his team in Japan. So NHL teams are doing this kind of work, and maybe one day we will get all that information. I don't know.
One of the things that the error stat and the scoring chance stat that doesn't do is allow for quality of teammate and quality of opposition. How do you feel the next step is for us to progress from there?
You know, if we had the kind of scoring chance work that I'm doing for every team, it could be a basis for a good quality of competition or quality of teammate number. And you know, that kind of thing is crucial. We all know that, right? It's, you're one player on the ice. You can only have so much of effect on the game. You got your four teammates, your five opposition, they have a huge impact on your own numbers. So, you know, for now, I go by Desjardins' numbers for quality of competition and quality of teammate. I think that they're fairly strong, and they match up, generally speaking, with how I see the rankings on the Oilers, at least. So, you know, I wish we had better numbers, and I know how important that is, but, you know, it's just something that as we get better numbers to rate each individual player, we will have better overall quality of competition and teammate numbers as well.
The revelation for me this year was the difference it makes. It's clear to me that Tom Rennie is rolling four lines, and he's like baptism by fire for these kids. And what happens is it really makes a mess of the quality of competition number, where it's not as reliable as it was, for instance, when Craig McTavish was coaching the team, and you really did feel like he was line matching very closely.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to think who does get the toughest quality of competition. Like, if you try to think of the Edmonton Oilers, who gets that? Like, just think of the three centers. Can we honestly say who's had tougher competition? Or the better line mates even on the Oilers, Cogliano, Gagné, or Horkov? It's kind of hard to figure that out. You know, you might guess that Horkov has had tougher competition and better line mates. But between the other two, and I think it would be close between all three, with Fraser kind of fourth in both categories. So, yeah, I agree. It's not a very structured approach. They have their own structure and their own way of doing things, but it's not helping us figure that kind of thing out this year. Not obvious, like it was under McKee.
Right. Bill James, years and years ago, he started something called, he's a great baseball writer, he started something called Project Scoresheet, and the idea was, and it came from a newspaper in Kansas City, the idea was to have someone in every Major League Baseball city actually tracking all kinds of things, like first to third on a single to left field, that sort of thing, very specific items that were in what was called Project Scoresheet, and two or three people ended up doing it for each Major League Baseball game as time went on. Is that something that you see eventually happening, either by the group community on the internet or by the National Hockey League as some kind of advanced stat for contracts?
I think that at SB Nation, they're already getting together to do scoring chances, and various guys have taken various teams and are breaking down scoring chances. So I think that's a step in the right direction. So I think we're already headed there. I do think to get a better kind of scoring chance plus minus, you do have to break down each play and try to figure out who was involved in the scoring chances for and who made mistakes on the scoring chances against. That is a much more difficult effort because you have to have set criteria that everyone follows and abides by. And there has to be consistency between how two people rate different games and rate different plays, which is hard to get. So I don't know if we're going to get that step, but I do think we're going to get scoring chance data for all the teams, and SB Nation will provide that. Now, I don't know if they're going to make it public or not. Sometimes I have trouble finding their results, but we are definitely headed in that direction, and I think it's fans who are going to be leading the charge on this.
This is Nation Radio on Team 1260. We are live at the Pint, 109th and Jasper, with David Staples of the Edmonton Journal. David, I want to change pace a little bit here and ask you a little bit about yourself. I think we had parallel careers here in a way. We were doing things. You were doing things at the journals. I was doing things at CFRN. But you were hanging around with Matheson and Cole, and I was hanging around with Rod Phillips and John Short. So we were on the edge of this sort of thing for a long time. What made you decide that you wanted to get into the sports aspect after a successful career, more on the news side?
You know, I when I first got into journalism, I wanted to be a sports writer. That was my, and I just never got that opportunity in the 80s. And then I started to get into different kinds of reporting, and I started to really like it. So, you know, my career took me into covering crime reporting and City Hall and politics and stuff like that. But I've always been very interested in sports writing. And would dabble in sports writing now and then, writing profiles of various Oiler players and coaches and stuff like that through the years. And I was involved in stories here and there. So, you know, when the internet came, it just freed up things for everyone. If you had an interest, suddenly you could pursue it on kind of on your own time. And for the first year at the Journal, that's exactly what it was, on my own time. It had nothing to do with my job. I was just a hobbyist writing the cult of hockey, kind of, you know, writing what I wanted to say. And everyone kind of, many people on the Oilosphere took me as kind of a mainstream media voice, when really I was just like them, a fan, who did have a bit of, you know, because I would sometimes talk to Maddie or people like that. I would hear a little bit of this or that, but really I am and remain just a fan. And, you know, there was such intense work going on the Oilosphere involving statistics, and I soon realized, like, if I'm going to be serious about this, I really have to think hard about this, up my game, and do a much better job of this kind of work. And so that's what I've been trying to do the last 3 or 4 years here, is try to come up with some things that make sense to me in terms of rating hockey players.
Every one of the folks who I have on and talking to about advanced stats, I ask them this question. So will you share with us, when you're looking at a player, say the Oilers acquire someone and it's from a different team and you don't know much about them, what are the advanced stats that you value the most and go to get an idea about that player?
You know, I find that the hardest thing in the world is when the Oilers pick up another player from another team, because I'm just not really, I look at time on ice, actually.
Yep,
I think that says a lot about a player. I mean, it says, did his coach trust him, you know, to be out there on the power play, on the penalty kill? How much at even strength did his coach trust him? I mean, look at Colin Fraser. We can see, you know, he got less and less ice time last year. He was on the penalty kill the year before, not last year, not in the playoffs. So it's like when he came here, we're all hoping he's going to be this great penalty killer and a defensive player, but clearly the Hawks had stopped trusting him in those roles. So time on ice is actually, to me, one of the biggest indications of what the coach and the other team is thinking of this guy, and it's something that I really look at. It's not an advanced stat, but it's one I favor.
No, it's a valuable stat.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I guess really that's my main stat when I look at other players, because so many other things are based on quality of teammate and quality of competition to such a large extent. It's kind of hard to tell from many plus-minus numbers, including, I find, Corsi plus-minus, whether a player really is effective or not. Someone like Patrick O'Sullivan might come, and he might have a lot of shots, and he might have a good Corsi number, but it's in the end, it's because he was playing, I think, with good line mates, and we just didn't realize that. So I'm just a little bit skeptical of relying on stats, and I don't really comment too much when trades are made, because I don't know about who's coming in the other direction too much, because the stats, I just don't have the confidence in them.
Yeah, good point. And the good thing about it is time on ice never lies. The spring of 2006, the Oilers' top four even-strength defensemen were Chris Pronger, Jaro Spaschek, Steve Staios, and Jason Smith. And, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that we're a little ways away from that kind of quality and depth at this point in the Oilers' history. David, while we've got you on the phone, you have been the go-to guy on the arena for quite some time now for several Team 1260 folks. Can you give us an update of where we're at right now and what we can look forward to in the future?
I think it's coming down to crunch time. I think I think a deal is soon going to be put before council about how to proceed on this, and councils are going to have to decide. There's $350 million that has been spoken for, in terms of this project. K2's going to put up $100 million. The city's going to put up $125 million. And there's going to be a ticket tax, $125 million. Ticket tax is a user fee. It's money that otherwise might go to the owner of the team, to Kate. So it's kind of, it's private money. It's best seen that way. So right now, of the first $350 million that's come forward, 70% private, 30% public. There's $100 million, though, to come, and I don't see the city coming up with any more money. So I think that Mr. Cates is going to have to come up with some more money, and we'll see if the province comes through with some money for this arena. I know that they're going to get pressure in Calgary to provide money, so maybe they'll figure something out in that line. So I think it's going to be, it's shaping up to be, I think, a pretty good deal. It's going to, for everyone involved, there's going to be a little bit of risk for everyone. It's going to be serious risk for Cates, but there's going to be a lot of private money, and I think that's very important on a deal like this.
So the Northlands portion of that deal is no longer a big issue?
You know, I think it is an issue. I just think Northlands had to bring money to the table. To get involved in any business deal, you have to bring money to the table, and they haven't done so.
Well, they did last time, right?
Last time in 74, Alan, they put together the whole deal. They brokered the whole deal, essentially. They got the 100% of the financing was done through them, you know, put together by them. They had a lot of clout, more clout back then, because they controlled horse racing, which was a huge industry back then, and it's no longer so. They used to be tied much more deeply into all aspects of the political world. And so this time they weren't able to, so I don't think they're, you know, I think that they may find a use for the Coliseum, complementary use, or we'll see what happens there. But I think Northlands, they've got a lot up there with the World Trade Expo Center. It's a $150 million building, all public money. They've got to make sure they run that at a profit. They've got lots to do with horse racing. They've got lots on their plate to figure out. And I think it's time that the rink came downtown and we go from there.
All right, David, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, Al.
All right, David Staples from the Edmonton Journal. That, you know, that is what he just said there. That is absolutely huge for somebody who's lived in this city for a long time. The change is going to be absolutely immense with this deal when it finally does come down. And there's lots of people, if you know folks in various parts of the groups involved, there's going to be a lot of people who are, lives will be changed by this. It's a big, big deal, and it obviously is coming. This is Nation Radio. We're live at the Pint, 109th Street and Jasper Avenue. Coming up next, we'll talk to Jonathan Willis from OilersNation.com.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
We are live today at the Pint, 109th and Jasper, Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260. And I think it's 1-0 for Montreal. Okay. And that's still in the first period. By the way, you know, we're having a lot of fun down here. Lots of people coming by. That's terrific to see. I know a lot of our thoughts today are with the folks in Japan and the Asia Pacific with the earthquake and tsunami. You know, our prayers go out to those folks. And I know Edmonton being a very generous city as it is, and Alberta specifically, that lots of people will want to contribute. You can go online to the team1260.com. We have a place where you can click on and donate through the Canadian Red Cross and their relief efforts. And you know what? I know whenever the need is there, Edmontonians respond, and definitely the need is there in this particular case. Jonathan Willis joins us now from OilersNation.com. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm doing great, Alan. How are you?
Good. You wrote three articles today that I want to talk to you a little bit about. The first one is on Colton Tubert. You talked. You mentioned in the article that most estimates for Tubert have him as an NHL depth player, and I know that somebody had tweeted, the organization had said that he'd be a number five guy. Math does not lend itself to that type of player very well. He's not an offensive sort of a guy. How do you see him being used in the NHL? Do you see him as a PK guy or just an even strength kind of 5'6" Scott Ferguson type?
I expect he'll be a penalty killer just because that kind of a player with that kind of physical skills with a defensive mindset, even in the 5'6" role, almost always ends up being used on the penalty killing unit. I know math doesn't. I totally agree with you that it's difficult to project defensive defensemen, but I think the big indicator for an American Hockey League defenseman is how he's being used. And from what we can tell, it looks to me like Colton Tubert hasn't been used as a top pairing defender most of the time in the AHL, which is something you'd really like to see from a guy who's close to NHL ready. We don't know how he'll progress, but it's difficult to see him stepping in immediately when he's not an impact defenseman in the American League.
Right. He was playing on a very deep team with the LA Kings minor league system, and I know that in his first few games with the Oklahoma City Barons, he's had more of an impact both offensively and on the PK. He's 5 games, 2 goals, and an assist, and a plus +2. Do you see the Oilers possibly using him more offensively just out of need at the minor league level?
I think it's probably too early to say that. They do have a number of other options with Chorney out and Petry recalled to the big club. They're somewhat limited, but they still have players like Brian Helmer and Kevin Montgomery who they added at the deadline. So I think time will tell with Tubert. It's possible they'll use him in that role, especially with the kind of start he's had in Oklahoma, but I don't know if we'll see him stay in that role based on his history.
The main issue that I think most people had with the Tubert trade, the Penner part of that, was that type of player, that sort of role player, is somewhat readily available. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree that you're not going to get anything you can't find on the open market in Colton Tubert.
Another item you posted on ON talked about Linus Ullmark, and I found it very interesting because you had what jumped out at me was that you feel he might be a high-percentage shooter. Can you give me the background there and why you feel that way?
Well, the thing with Linus Ullmark is that he has a track record of scoring goals, and shooting percentage is actually something I've been worried about with him at various other levels. He's played in the Swedish Elite League, the top league in Russia, the KHL, as well as the American Hockey League, and in all those leagues, he was a guy who converted a high percentage of his shots. Now, sometimes what happens with a high shooting percentage player is that they're on a tear, they're on a really good run, and they're unable to replicate it. But in Omar's case, we have 3 or 4 years of data that suggests, at least at these lower levels, that he's a very good shooter. He's got a very good shot, and we haven't really seen that so far at the NHL level. Right now, his shooting percentage is quite low, and there's at least some reason for optimism that he can improve upon his number so far, because right now he's at Patrick O'Sullivan level.
And you mentioned as well that he had a good, or at least decent, Corsi number, but his plus-minus wasn't good, and the culprit appears to be save percentage behind him, right?
Yeah, and that's something that we saw last year with Sean Horkoff, where the team wasn't really getting brutally outshot with him on the ice, but a lot of those pucks had a tendency to go in, and this year it's been the opposite. He's getting shot at by about the same rate, but the pucks are not going in the net. I think last year he was a .880 save percentage on the ice, and this year he's up around .930. So that's something that fluctuates wildly from year to year, and I think it's one of the reasons we need to take Ullmark's plus-minus with a grain of salt.
So because of the fact that it'll go back to the median, the odds are that he'll be, his plus-minus will be more representative of his overall play next year. You did a really nice overview of the value of a draft pick on Oilers Nation this week. And I like the story because you called in 3 or 4 different studies and came up with several really interesting conclusions. You say top 5 overall is gold. How often does a top 5 pick end up going sideways?
It does happen, particularly in weaker drafts. I think we can all think of names, a guy like Pavel Brendl or a guy like Patrick Stefan. In years where the same level of quality isn't there in the top 5 picks, but in most years, those top 5 picks are so much better and have such a higher degree of not only turning out as NHL players, but turning out as impact players, that if a team can move up into that range, it's almost always worth it. And that might sound pretty obvious. Obviously, everybody wants a higher draft pick, but that elite talent we've seen is almost always clustered at the very top.
Your next point runs counterintuitively to Oilers fans who saw the Edmonton Oilers trade down, lose out on Zach Parise and others, pick up Mark Pouliot and J.F. Jacques in the deal. But your research says that after the top 5, moving down in the first round is a good idea.
Yeah, as a rule, because the thing is there's a steep drop-off from the talent available in the top five picks to the rest of the first round. But between the 15th and 30th spots in the first round, there is a slight drop-off, but it's very, very minimal in comparison. And that's been shown in various studies. I was inspired by Jason Greger's work to look into this a little bit more, but three or four different people have looked at this, and they've all come to the same basic conclusion that the drop-off between 15th and 30th is not nearly as great as it is at the top end of the draft. And just to address the Pouliot issue, I think the thing we forget with that sometimes is that the Oilers were really targeting Robert Nilsson, mm-hmm. and he went one pick before the Oilers traded down, and when that player left, they thought, well, we can trade down now because the guy we want isn't there. So if he hadn't been selected at 16, if Zach Parise had been selected at 16, we'd have taken a very different lesson from that, that it would have been wise to trade down rather than take Nilsson at 17.
Very good point. And outside the first round through 100, you're dealing in a all picks are not equal, but if you can pick up two in the 50s for one in the 40s, that's a good deal, right?
Absolutely. The difference, and I was really surprised to see this because I thought we'd see a fairly steady drop all the way down, but the difference between a fifth-round pick and even an old eighth- or ninth-round pick, of course, the draft only goes seven rounds now, but the difference is it's almost non-existent. In fact, over the last few years, I think the tendency has been that the fifth round has been outperformed by the sixth round. And because the gap is so narrow, I think the real objective here should be to get quantity of picks rather than quality of picks. If you can trade a fifth round pick for a sixth and a seventh round pick, you should do it every time.
And your article at ON had one more item that I found very interesting, because it seems as though the National Hockey League does this naturally, but you drove it home vehemently, and it makes sense. If you're a team looking for added depth, and I think always of Buffalo in the spring of 2006 who ran out of defensemen, that's why they lost in the conference finals to Carolina. If you're thinking of adding depth and it's a pick outside the top 100, make the deal 100 times out of 100, right?
Yes, absolutely. There's no reason any team that thinks they can contend or even thinks they can go on a decent run should hang on to a depth draft pick over a veteran. The thing is, you can find the kind of players that those draft picks turn into in the open market very cheaply, and you have a very limited window to win in the NHL. So if you can trade one of these really long shot lottery scratch and win ticket type picks for an actual NHL player who's going to help you win, you have to do it every single time.
Got an email here from Steve from Calgary. He said, this may be a good question for Jonathan Willis. I've read many articles on websites and Oilers Nation recently and in previous years about quantifying the value of a draft pick. All of these articles seem to measure the success of a draft pick in terms of the player reaching the NHL level to some extent. Do you think a late-round pick, say a fourth or later, could be considered a success if that player becomes a solid AHL player, temporary NHL call-up? And do you think an NHL team would consider that a successful pick, or is the NHL the only measure of success for a draft pick?
I think they should consider that a successful pick, no question. A player like that, the odds of them turning into somebody useful are quite low. So a player that can play regularly in the American Hockey League, can act as depth and an injury call-up, that's very valuable. And just to go a little further with that, it's part of the reason I think teams should really push for boom or bust selections later in the draft. Because if you can get a player who has, say, a one in 20 chance of turning, as opposed to a player who's got a 1 in 10 chance of turning into a depth player, always go with the good player, because those depth players are so easily replaceable in the open market.
So take Niinimaki just at 115 instead of number 15.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oilers pick at number one. If you had to predict right now who they'll take, what would the name be?
I think they'll take Adam Larson. Yeah. I don't really have much to back that up, but I have difficulty seeing them take Nugent Hopkins. I think they're so set on the wings that they'll have trouble taking Landeskog. So for drafting for need, it's either Sean Couturier or Adam Larson, and based on what all the scouts are saying, I have to think it's going to be Larson.
Jonathan, thanks for this, and you're in town next weekend, right?
I am indeed.
Okay, we'll have you on live on the show then if we can arrange that. Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Thanks so much, Alan. Always a pleasure.
Jonathan from Oilers Nation, Jonathan Willis, and various other sites. He writes some absolutely astounding stuff. If you haven't read him before, drop by. And usually two or three a week that are really insightful and make you think. Coming up in the next hour, we've got three very interesting guests. Kurt Ludeke from the Bruins Draft Watch 2011 will talk about the Zdeno Chara hit and a couple of other items that involve the Bruins plus the 2011 draft. And also we'll get to Jim Beyer from the Oklahoma City Barons. He's their play-by-play guy. We'll get some updates on people like Harda Kanen and others. And coming up after 1 o'clock, Jeff Crischel from the Crush Health Show coming up.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
We are live at the Pint and 109th Street and Jasper Avenue. Lots of people coming by. There's a hockey game and there's some curling going on, and we've got it all covered and some great food and beverages as well. Make sure you drop by and say hello to me. I have some tickets for the Oil Kings as well coming up in the next the Red Deer and Lethbridge games. I've got some tickets with parking passes too, which is very cool. And that and more coming up between now and 2 o'clock. In this hour, going to be talking to Oklahoma City's play-by-play guy, Jim Beyer. Their season is coming down and it's looking very close for a playoff spot. And some of those kids that they sent down to the farm out of training camp last year, like Timo Hartikainen, are really impressing, and there's a good chance we'll see them at the NHL level before the end of the year. Also, Kurt Ludeke, we'll talk to him about the Zdeno Chara incident, how that's playing in Boston, and a little bit about the 2011 draft as well. Okay, coming up at 4 o'clock today and every Thursday between 8 and 9 is the Crush Health Show, one of the most interesting shows on Team 1260 or anywhere. And the host, Jeff Crischel, joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Good. How are you today?
All right, buddy. I'm very well. Hey, I've got a few questions, so I want to get right to them. Sam Gagner, the injury there, it was first described as a short surgical surgery where doctors found no major tears. Then later we got a report about a severed tendon. So without going into specifics, because it's a little blurry here, for a skilled player like Gagner, could that kind of thing have long-term implications?
Yeah, no, I don't think it would be long-term. The one thing you got to understand, the medicine and the medical procedures that we have now are just like nothing we've ever seen in terms of sports. So in terms of return to play, even with the connective tissue, very avascular, so there's not a lot of blood supply, it could take a long time to heal. But depending exactly where it is, and if it is totally severed, I mean, they can reattach and work some magic nowadays like they've never been able to do before. Now, in terms of getting back to play, you know, the type of tendon that has been severed, that, of course, has a major implication on the return to play. You know, the Achilles tendon, for example, as you can imagine and appreciate, is a very, very severe return to play. But we've had athletes come back from totally ruptured Achilles tendons. But when it comes to, like, the fine motor movements, it can maybe have some impact on the tactile and the touch, you know, especially for a skilled player. But I don't think they're going to predict that for this one.
Okay. Mike Modano is in the Edmonton Journal today talking about he could relate to the injury. He just had it not too terribly long ago. And he said that they told him with the nerve damage and that it would be a year. But he's a 40-year-old athlete. Sam Gagner is 21. Does that recovery at a 21-year-old, that's a lot quicker, right?
Yeah, potentially can be. Now, when we talk about neural damage, that's a whole different ball of wax. There's a big difference between a severed tendon and actually nerve damage. So you know, that goes into a whole other realm. And the nervous system, you know, it's still kind of maybe like one of those uncharted territories when it comes to the human body and human physiology. We don't really know everything we need to know about it yet, but it does regenerate. We do know that. And guys have recovered. And then, Al, there's this thing called cortical mapping where, you know, if we do have problems with the nervous system, we can retrain other parts of the brain or other neural networks to take over. So all of that is entirely possible. But no question, you know, the younger you are, the quicker you recover.
Okay. Speaking of young and quick recovery, did you see that Taylor Hall video where he got into the fight?
Yes, I did.
I came out of that thinking there had to be knee ligament damage of some sort and maybe serious. Turns out he has a high ankle sprain. Is he made of rubber or is that unbelievable?
Yeah, he could be made of rubber, that's for darn sure. And again, you know, in the heat of battle, it's amazing what the body can endure. And I think that's a good example of that. And you know, when an athlete is highly trained, this is one of the reasons when we look at training an athlete, we look at the full spectrum. Flexibility is certainly one of them. Range of motion is another one. But, you know, when a guy is highly trained and tuned in, you know, little injuries like that, you can't avoid. And again, hence, kudos to the strength and conditioning program and athletic development, because you put a normal human being in there, they'd probably be out and down for the count.
Okay. And it turned him into a high ankle sprain, which is a nightmare unto itself, right?
Yeah, it can be. Again, depending on the severity and exactly what's been affected, ankle sprains, especially for a skating athlete. And again, you're just looking at that time to heal. There is no fast-tracking the healing time of the body. You know, if you maximize nutrition, you maximize the rehab, and of course, the Oilers have one of the best medical teams in the league, no question about it. So we'll expect that he's either going to be right on course or ahead of schedule in the terms of return to play.
They said 8 weeks, which would put him in and around the World Hockey Championships. Is that reasonable for us to at least expect that might be possible?
Yeah, in terms of return to play, yeah, for sure. And again, depending on how severe it actually was, and again, everybody's different, right? It's so individualistic. And there's so many factors involved. But, you know, typically 6 to 8 weeks, you can have an athlete, a fine-tuned athlete back, potentially even before then. But I'm sure they're in no rush here looking at the situation. And this is not something I don't think you'd ever want to rush anyway. So I think they got a beautiful time frame to work with.
I was at the Bruins-Oilers game a couple of weeks ago at Rexall, and Theo Peckham fought, I think it was Nathan Horton, didn't return to the game. He's listed as out day-to-day with a concussion. There's really been no information, which is maybe good. Can you take me through the process a professional athlete has to go through when he's concussed?
Yeah, well, you know, and things are rapidly changing, Al, as you can appreciate. We're, you know, there's a big conversation going on in the sports world of, you know, whether there's actually more concussions right now or actually whether we're more aware of exactly what they are, the symptoms, and we're assessing them better. But regardless, the return to play protocols are getting very sophisticated, and it's the best thing we've ever seen for the athletes. And, you know, when you do have some form of minor brain trauma or brain injury or concussion, you know, we're trying to get away from that concussion because it can be misleading as to the symptoms and the type of injury that happens to the brain. So we like to talk about these mild traumatic brain injuries sort of scenarios. And, you know, depending on the level, you will sort of determine the return to play. But regardless of what the symptoms are, if you have had symptoms, and there's a whole list that we would take an athlete through, you know, and if they show signs of a combination of those symptoms, they are out. One and done is sort of the rule right now, Alan. So once an athlete has been assessed with an athlete, they are out of competition. Now, they have to be, typically the way we like to do it is they have to be 24 hours symptom-free before they start a return-to-play program. And, of course, that return-to-play program will be vastly determined by the length of time they've been out of competition.
So would a team have a baseline from spring training or training camp, and the individual would have to pass whatever that is before getting back into the process of getting ready to play?
Yeah, really, really great question. And what's happening now is, you know, athletes that have had previous concussions, they're constantly getting assessed and analyzed by the medical training staff and the doctors on the teams. And this is regardless of the sport. And, Al, this is something we should also really be thinking about at the developmental levels. The great thing about being in these pro guys, they have all these medical experts around them to keep them safe and make sure everything's on track. In the developmental levels, we don't have this, but we can really learn a lot from this. So what they do is they take either a SCAT-2 form, which is a concussion assessment tool, the number 2 form that's been modified. That's the one that's typically being used in sports right now. And it just takes the athletes through a questionnaire, and it takes them through symptoms and really gets a good depiction of their state of health. We like to do this before the season starts, and especially with athletes who had concussions or head injuries before. And then we get a baseline of, you know, their state or their present fitness. Now, when we think they may have had a concussion or a brain injury or whether they've been in a collision, a lot of times athletes don't even know if they've had a concussion because they don't know what the symptoms are. And on the other side, a lot of times the symptoms don't always show themselves clearly. So anytime we see an athlete who may have been in a collision or in a high-impact situation, we'll reassess them compared to the baseline. And if there's any type of deviation, we'll get a pretty good read as to whether there's been some form of head trauma there. So it's a really good question, and it's something we should be doing with all of our athletes, especially at the developmental levels.
This is Nation Radio. We're live at the Pine 109th and Jasper on Edmonton Sports Radio Team 1260. It's Alan Mitchell in conversation with Jeff Crichel. Jeff, you know, a few years ago, I think it was like December of 09, I read an article about an old-timey hockey player I remember as a kid, played in the WHA, named Reg Fleming, and he had donated his brain to, I think, the Boston University. They did a study in July, and it was released around Christmas of 09, and it talked about the tremendous degenerative disease known as I can't even pronounce it here. It's encephalopathy. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty close. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. And, hey, Alan, we can look at the Chris Benoit story. We can look at the studies they've done on the NFL players who have passed away and donated their brains and their bodies to science. And we've seen, incredibly accelerated degenerative diseases. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, all these types of neurological diseases that you might, typically sort of correlate with old age. We're seeing in these athletes who die at 50 or 60 years old, and it's a real, real concerning problem. And, when an athlete, and this is one of the reasons we have to be very conscious of athletes who are experiencing head traumas, because here it is, it's a cumulative effect, which is something a lot of people don't realize. The second impact is incredible. A much higher potential for damage than the first one, the third one potentially higher, and then the fourth one down the road. So, the cumulative effect in terms of head injuries, it packs on and it can grow in exponential rate depending on the particular athlete, but not a very uncommon thing when we look at the accelerated brain degeneration with boxing athletes, football athletes, and certainly the hockey guys.
So the NHL is meeting on Monday. Starting on Monday, the big leagues are meeting on this subject. What ideally would we look for them to come out of that meeting with?
Well, the NFL, and this is going to be interesting, they're going to have to kind of do something, but here's my question right back to you. I hate to answer a question with a question, but to open this for discussion, what can they do? We know that these athletes are bigger, they're faster, they're stronger. We had a talk recently with the chief medical officer for the NFL Players Association. Of course, the NFL is facing very, very similar things, and they've had some major congresses. I hope the NHL really sort of latches on or tag teams or uses the NFL as a reference point or as a partner in this whole thing, because the sports have a lot in common when it comes to head injuries. But in the NFL, they're doing some pretty unique things. They've looked to the military, for example, and what they're doing now is they're getting the teams to work out a buddy system with their players. So in the Navy, in the Army, what they do is you have a buddy, one of the soldiers in your unit, and you guys sort of keep track of each other. They're going to start implementing that in the NFL now, where you're going to be matched with a player on your unit or your line, certainly on your team, and then you're going to sort of keep track of each other. If the guy isn't acting properly, it's going to be up to the buddy to either, go talk to him or make to the trainers and the coaches aware of what's going on. So I think that's one thing they can do. But then I think, in the NFL they're talking about it as well, there has to be an incredibly harsh discipline. The problem there is, how do you define the issue? I mean, we could look at what happened last week in the NHL, and was that intentional? Was it not intentional? How do you discipline that? Or whether it's intentional or not, if it's an out-of-control situation, I think you got to pay the price.
I think it's funny you mentioned the Chara thing, because I had my own opinion on it. I thought, clearly he deserved to get a penalty. I thought that the kicking him out of the game was enough. Others wanted a suspension, but that he'd done something illegally. But I talked to somebody who played at a high level, but not in the National Hockey League, and he had an interesting take. He said, at some point, it's almost the responsibility of the athlete, who in this case was Pacioretty, who got hurt, to realize that the situation is not going his way and to back off. And I said, can he think that quickly? And the answer from the individual was yes. Do you think it's fair to say that sometimes, not necessarily Pacioretty, but sometimes these guys put themselves in a position where they are really not putting themselves in a good situation?
Yeah, and again, great point, very strong point. It's something that we've talked about quite a bit. And if you look at the type of player they are, you have those hard-hitting players. Of course, they're going to be in there grinding away. They're not going to give an inch. They just aren't going to give an inch in competition. So I don't know if it's realistic to expect guys to give an inch, but I will say this. In a dangerous situation, these guys have been on the ice or in the game long enough to know when somebody could potentially get hurt. And that's where we just have to be incredibly aware and disciplined and being consistent with enforcing these, roughing rules or, whatever they're going to call it, but it just has to be a consistent approach.
I think what the NHL is going to have to do eventually, and I don't know how many years it's going to take, is outlaw headshots and fighting. Do you think there's the appetite for that?
Yeah, I think there is, and I think there's a growing appetite, especially now the way the game is going so fast. The guys are so strong. Guys are getting hurt more simply because of that reason, and so the game is going to have to evolve with the athletes. There's no way around it.
What about equipment? Because I know that the shoulder pads are often, because of the difference in height, they often end up being the item that really does the damage.
Yeah, no question, and that's true. And they also, on the other side, they're built for protection, not to elicit a damage response or damage, right? So again, that's a double-edged sword as well. But you know, one thing that's really coming along is the helmet technology, and you know, in terms of concussions, can they you know, have an impact on decreasing the risk of the concussion or hand injuries? Well, when you're going fisticuffs, you know, head-on. The pile driver, haymaker is coming at you. There's no helmet in the world that's going to help you. So, you know, there's a lot of issues involved here, and it's a delicate thing. You don't want to take away from the game, but at the same time, you have to provide a safe environment, a playing environment for the athletes. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they proceed here.
I imagine somebody driving their kid to a hockey game right now, and we're scaring the hell out of them. So let's talk about what a parent can do for a child who is in hockey right now, and there is physical contact. What's the procedure? What's the best thing for them to do?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the things that we're really encouraging, and it's happening across the board, across Canada, is we're really making sure that somebody on the team does have a background, or at least is educated slightly on the head injury concussion side. Not all of these teams have trainers. There's not medical staff down at the arena, so, you know, somebody on the team has to be responsible for that. But you know what? The kids just have to be aware. And in the developmental levels, maybe there's even more potential for injury, simply because they're a little more out of control. They don't have the finesse, they don't have the skill or the strength sometimes to handle their body weight at those high speeds. And again, the risk of injury goes up. So awareness is the key. The kids just got to be aware. And, you know, you have to be aware of the situation you're in, just like we talked about with the pro guys. If you think you're in a dangerous situation, well, you probably are, and you got to be on your toes and ahead of that. That's sort of one of those intangible things. It's tough to say, you know, on the radio and then to make it happen on the ice. But as long as the kids are thinking about it and they're aware of it, I think that's a big step forward.
Yeah, we're making progress. I mean, when I was a kid, you wore bone skates, and if you got hit in the head,
exactly.
They'd laugh at you. They'd say, oh, you got your bell rung. Get out there. You know, there
right.
it was sort of a man-up thing, right?
Yeah.
And at least we're getting away from that when we realize that there's some long-term implications, and I think the Probert, and now with what's happening with Sidney Crosby, I think that's what happens with someone like Crosby who's not getting better. I think of Adam Deadmarsh, who came back early years ago, and then he got into a fight. He was challenged to a fight, and he fought, and it took him years, Jeff, to recover, and his life was never the same.
Yeah, and I think Sidney Crosby may be one of the powerful spokespeople for this, and of course he's raised the awareness, and despite all the bad for Sidney Crosby, this could be something that's really important for the game in terms of, you know, moving it forward. But you cannot rush Sidney Crosby. There is no way you bring this kid back until he has met the guidelines and he's comfortable. And again, you know, if you heard the interviews when it first happened, he was confused. He could not verbalize or describe the feelings he was having. He was just off. I think that's how he said, I just feel off. I can't explain it, right?
Yep.
And that's what a lot of athletes experience. It's not necessarily a headache or a pounding headache or blurred vision. Sometimes it's this very elusive feeling that you're just not quite all there. But again, Al, you cannot return to play until you've been 24 hours symptoms free.
Yep.
And I don't know when it's going to happen for Sidney Crosby, but, you know, hopefully one day. Some of the athletes that we've worked with, you know, they wake up and they go, whoa, Eureka, I feel like $1 million. It's like a flick of the switch. Some guys, you know, over the course of 3 days, they feel like $1 million, and it's like this big sigh of relief, this big load off their shoulders. So we'll keep our fingers crossed for Sidney for sure, but this is not something to be rushed along. There's no two ways about it.
Off subject a little bit, this is via email for you, Jeff. What is the evidence that regular aerobic exercise and weight training can actually make old guys like this individual, over 50, physically younger?
Oh, no question. Well, there's a lot of science on the fountain of youth. And if you're really going to ask me where the fountain of youth would be found, it's in the weight room, no question about it. Resistance training. And it all has to do with the hormones. Anytime you get into the weight room, or if you do an aerobic workout that pushes the body above its, you know, its resting level, you're going to have a hormone response. Anytime you damage tissue or stress the body out, it responds by releasing hormones, growth hormone, testosterone, to repair damage. And that's why typically, you know, athletes look younger. If they train properly, they'll look younger, they'll feel younger, because their hormone levels are elevated, you know, higher than the average person. So no question about that whatsoever. And, you know, one thing we really, really encourage people to do is get with a certified trainer, NSCA, a certified strength and conditioning coach who has a degree in the sports science, and get into a real good program. You know, it's not about lifting weights necessarily. We could do it with body weight exercises, but there's absolutely no question if it's done properly, it could be, you know, quote, well, not even a quote, but it could mimic the Fountain of Youth, so to speak.
Beautiful. See, I always learn something when I talk to you. Two quick ones. How do the Blue Jays look this year?
The Blue Jays are looking better than they have in a long time. It's simply because I think they've got some balance, and not just that, but a real plan moving forward. Now, if you look at the AL East, man, it's impossible. Look at Boston, look at New York, so they're up against it. Tampa's not going to be bad either. But, I mean, that's the best division to watch in baseball. But you know, talking to the Blue Jays, they're looking really good. But, man, you've got to look at that Phillies starting rotation, and it'll just drive you nuts. If you're a drinking man, watch out, because, holy cow, if you're not cheering for the Phillies, it's going to be a long, hard season.
What about that kid from the Nationals with the golden arm and then it fell apart? Is he going to be back?
Well, the talk is he's going to be back. And, you know, one thing we were worried about with that kid is, you know, just how hard he was throwing. You know, it's one thing to be in the minor leagues or come up through college, you know, throw a couple times a week and, you know, have the short seasons. But when you're in a 162-game schedule, potentially throwing every 5 days with your bullpens in between, playing catcher, it's a whole different animal. And even though they had a really good strategic plan for monitoring and you know, managing his arm, because he throws over 100 miles an hour when he wants to, I still think they should have cut it back to velocity. This is just my personal opinion, and I think that's what they'll do going forward. But, again, it would be great to see him back on the mound this year for sure.
Jeff Gershell, thanks so much for this.
You got it. I'll talk to you soon.
You're on at 4 o'clock today, right?
4 o'clock, yep.
What's on the show?
Well, hey, we're talking about winter sports. We're looking at did the money from the Own the Podium and the support of the athletes going into the Olympics carry over to the World Cup this year? And we're also talking about the incredible event out at Jasper and Marmot Base in the World Junior National Freestyle Competition is on out there, and it's the next generation of Olympic athletes.
Jeff, thanks so much.
All right, Al.
Jeff Gershell, very interesting guy. You can catch him on Crush Health, and he also does some dynamite vignettes on Team 1260, and he's an industry unto his own. He is a very smart man, and we appreciate his time. It's 1:21. This is Nation Radio on Team 1260 Radio, Edmonton Sports Radio. We're at the Pint, 109th and Jasper until 2 o'clock today. On the way, Kirk Ludeke from Bruins Draft Watch.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 1:24. We're here until 2 o'clock today, live at the Pint, 109th and Jasper on Nation Radio. Joined now by Kirk Ludeke from Bruins Draft Watch and New England Hockey Journal. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Alan. Good to hear from you. Thanks for having me on the show.
You might as well just move to Edmonton. You're on twice a day, man. You might as well just move here.
Well, I guess I've made the big time. I'll tell you, if I'm on the radio in Edmonton, things are looking good because they don't make hockey towns much better than Edmonton.
Well, that's very kind of you. Hey, here in Edmonton, the Taylor Hall-Tyler Seguin debate has subsided at this point. Oilers fans are happy over the choice. Seguin has looked good when I've seen him. He backed off there a little bit, and they used him a little less, but he's coming on well. How's the overall view from Bruins fans in regard to Tyler Seguin?
Well, I think it's pretty clear if you you poll the average fan, they would like to see him get a little more ice time under Claude Julien. Some are a little perplexed at some of the healthy scratches and the opportunities that haven't been there for him. But at the same time, I mean, it's very clear and evident from watching Tyler that he's skilled, has the ability to be an NHL impact player. But the Bruins are in the luxury, or have the luxury of bringing him along slowly and making sure that he's learning all facets of the game and he's responsible. And I think Coach Julien will be the first to tell you that he wants to put out the team that he feels is best going to win hockey games. And if that means that he's sitting out Tyler Seguin along the way, then that's what he's going to do. But ultimately, I think fans are kind of wishing that they would see a little more ice time, but It is what it is at this point, and he is at least progressing and developing. I don't think the actions or the lack of actions hurting him. It's just from a fan's perspective, I think they'd like to see him playing a little more.
Well, he's a great insurance policy. And speaking of that, I really like how Chiarelli has put this roster together. He's got Chara at the front. He's got Caberlet now, Seidenberg, some really nice veteran group there. But he's also brought along two players that were quietly acquired via trade a couple of years ago, Kempfer and McQuaid. Both those kids look really good.
Yeah, definitely. I was talking about McQuaid today, and he's such an interesting player because, he was a second-round pick, so obviously the talent was noticed by Columbus. They drafted him early in 2005, but watching him in his first training camp, I mean, his skating was was subpar, and looking at him, you said, boy, he's got a long way to go if he's going to make the NHL. But to his credit, he did some work with Paul Vincent and really worked on his skating, and he's just gotten so much better. And he's a gentle giant off the ice. I mean, he's very soft-spoken, very pleasant, affable guy. But, you know, sometimes you run into these big guys that are real pleasant, kind of, like I said, the gentle giant off the ice, and their play tends to translate into the same kind of thing on the ice, and that drives people crazy. One thing about McQuaid is he is a serious tiger on the ice, and the way he plays with the snarl and the toughness really belies the way he is, you know, when he's in the room and he's you know, he has the skates off and everything. So that's good. And then Kampfer certainly has an impressive skill set. And it was unfortunate to see him get the concussion, because he really is, along with Carberlet, he's one of the few guys on the Bruins who can really move the puck and gain the zone by himself and really provide that puck moving presence that the Bruins don't have a lot in abundance. So it's a tough loss for Kampfer, but you know, hopefully he'll keep progressing and going through the protocol, and he'll be cleared for action to be able to get back out there.
Talk a little bit about the draft. We in Edmonton have been really measuring Larson versus Couturier here for a while, because they looked like the guys who are going to be 1-2 in the draft. But everything we're reading now sees Couturier going backwards a little bit. It's surprising to us because he's still posting numbers in the queue. What's the problem with Couturier's skill set?
I think the skating. I mean, that's really the big thing. I mean, he's just... he's got that size and his hockey sense and a shot and the ability to generate offense, but the feet are a bit of a concern, and I think that has to be what it is, because I mean he's a hardworking guy and a good kid. I had a chance to see him play at the World Juniors. I mean, he didn't have the biggest role for Canada, but you know, he certainly. You know, he brings the attributes you're looking for in terms of someone that's committed to being a player. It's just, I think, the heavy feet are what's kind of setting him back a little bit. And in this day and age, when they are such a premium on the speed of the game and the skating, you're looking at guys like Ryan Strome and Jonathan Huberdeau, emerging in that league, and they're better skaters. And you just say, it may be. There's more much ado over nothing. There could be a team sitting there in the top three that is sold on Sean Couturier, and he's not going to drop at all, and this could be just something that we're seeing kind of coming about in media circles and what's out there in the public. But you asked the question about the concern. I think that's where it would be with Couturier.
It's been a top four for a while now, and it appears as though a fifth member of the 2011 crop is getting mentioned now around number one or two, and that's Ryan Strome. What can you tell us about him?
I can't say enough about Strome and what he's done this year. I talked to his coach, Marty Williamson, and they knew what a talented guy he was when they got him from Barrie last year. But the way he has exploded and really just taken the bull by the horns on that Ice Dogs club. What I like about Strome is he can do everything. I mean, he can score goals. He can set them up. He's such a creative player. I mean, just watching him on the highlight videos, he just does some jaw-dropping stuff. And I think when you're looking at this, what teams are looking for in this day and age of the NHL, you not only need the guy that brings the skill set to the ice, but he's got to have that creative, that flair, that element to his game that says that, you know what, if my line mates aren't making it happen, if nothing else, I can go out and I can create on my own and give my team a chance to score a goal and make things happen and impact the game and change the game directly. And I think that's what Ryan Strome is doing for the Ice Dogs this year.
Is he the Jeff Skinner of this draft? Is he the guy who's going to fall to maybe 8 or 9 and then end up scoring 30 goals?
No, I don't think he's going to fall to 8 or 9.
Okay.
I think he's a top 5 pick, and the rate he's going could be even better. I mean, Strome is the kind of guy. I mean, I think I look at the kind of season he's having and the kind of impact he's making, and I say to myself, there's got to be a team there picking in that top five that just has to be in love with him right now in terms of his potential and his skill set. And I just don't think he's going to drop all that far. I mean, there's just too much projectable upside there for him to get to 8 and 9. If he does, boy, whoever gets him, I think, yeah, that could be a huge steal, and you could be looking at a Skinner-type scenario. I don't know if he's ready for the NHL, but based on, you know, in terms of, you know, physical aspects, but in terms of his skill level and his you know, creativity, his intangibles, I don't think it would be a stretch to say that he might be in the NHL next year. Yeah.
This is Nation Radio on Team 1260 Edmonton Sports Radio. We're live at the Pint at 109th and Jasper until 2 o'clock today in conversation with Kirk Ludeke from Bruins Draft Watch and New England Hockey Journal. Since we last talked, Kirk, the Oilers picked up another first-round pick, the L.A. pick. Is the quality of this draft good enough that the Oilers can expect to pick a really good player around number 20, a really good hockey player?
I believe so, yes. This draft is interesting, depending on who you talk to. It may not have the high-end talent at the top of some of the previous years, and we've kind of been spoiled in recent years with, you know, I'm talking in terms of your Deschenes and your Stamkos and Hedmans and what have you. But as far as depth goes, I'm being told that this is a very good draft. You're going to get some quality players, you know, solidly, you know, from the first round, the second round, and that... yeah, I mean, obviously every year you're going to have guys that are going to be project players. They're going to have some flaws in their game. But when I hear that this is a weak draft, I just can't agree with that. Based on what I've seen with my own eyes in terms of seeing certain players and then what I'm hearing from scouts, I think the depth of this draft is good. And if you're picking at 20, yeah, you have the opportunity to pick up a nice player, albeit probably one that's going to take some time and patience to develop.
With Larson and Dougie Hamilton and Ryan Murphy and a plethora of really good defensemen ranked in the top, you know, from 5 to 15, say, is there a candidate you feel defensively who might fall out of the range, a Cam Fowler type this year?
Someone who might fall out of 5
like
to 15?
The 5 to 12, 5 to 13 range and end up being available a little later in the teens, like Fowler was.
Well, I mean, I think as much, and I'll caveat that, I mean, I love Ryan Murphy's game, but, you know, he's out right now with a concussion, and that kind of thing is going to raise concerns because of the way this game is, and especially when you look at what happened the other night with Zdeno Chara and Max Pacioretty, and you just realize how much brute force and speed and violence these collisions are getting harder and harder every year. And so when a team's looking at investing a high draft pick on a player like a Ryan Murphy, you know, it's not always about the talent alone. I mean, you can't just say, well, he's just so talented, we have to take him here. I mean, they have to factor in, you know, realistically speaking, a player that lacks the size like he does, you know, how is he going to do durability-wise? Is he going to be able to hold up to some of these big hits that, you know, very good chances are he's going to be subjected to? And so, you know, on talent alone, Ryan Murphy should not flip at all. I mean, I think he's a terrific player, and he's a competitor, and he's a smart kid. And I think if we were just talking in a vacuum and saying, it's all about the skill, then no. I mean, you know, Murphy's exactly where you say you have him. But if teams are now kind of concerned about potentially investing that high pick on a player who, you know, could have some durability concerns going forward, then that's a potential issue. And then you might see him drop a little further than it's expected.
Kirk, is there a position that's really deep this year compared to last year or the year before?
Positions really deep. You know, I think there are some real quality centers in this group. I mean, you just keep seeing some of these names, and you look at who's out there. I mean, you're talking about Sean Couturier and Ryan Strome and Jonathan Huberdeau, and those guys are interchangeable too. I mean, they can play center, they can play wing, but that's becoming more and more important. That the ability to draft a player coming out of junior or coming out of college or what have you, who is capable of skating either up the middle or on the wing. It gives teams drafting them a little bit of flexibility in terms of how they employ them. So I think that's attractive as opposed to a straight winger. And I also, I mean, that there's good depth at defense, and I think the goalie class is underrated. You may not have clear-cut number, you know, first-round draft picks in as far as goalies go, but there are a lot of really quality netminders, and I just keep going back to the 1994 draft. You know, you saw guys like Jamie Storr and Eric Fichaud and Evgeny Ryabchukov drafted in the first round, and then you had Evgeny Nabokov and Thomas Vokoun and Tim Thomas and John Graham drafted in the ninth round. And so I think you can always find good goaltenders up and down the rounds of the draft. Just because you don't have, you know, high visible, high profile goalies doesn't mean you don't have a strong class. I think there's some pretty good goalies in this class.
And one final question here. It comes via email from Diggy DeLong. Hope I'm saying that right. With such a variety of players available at the top of the 2011 draft, none of which has really seemed to rise above the others, does this allow a team to draft more based on need as opposed to BPA?
That's a really interesting question. I would tell you that most teams I talk to really are going to go BPA most, especially when they're drafting so high, because you have to remember is a need in 2011 may not be a need in 2013 or 12, whenever that player's ready to reach the roster. And so I really don't think it does. I really don't think you do draft for need. However, I would caveat that by saying if you're a team, for example, like Boston, who has a high pick in your playoff team and a contender, yeah, you really can kind of maybe target a guy you know is mature enough and you feel is going to be playing next year and he addresses a need, as opposed to having to wait and see, you know, having to wait a couple years and trying to project him. So there's always that potential, but I still believe that teams are pretty sold on going best player available, just because it allows them to accrue assets and gives them flexibility to make trades later to shore up areas of weakness. Whereas if you draft for a need and then all of a sudden it's not a need anymore, it just kind of might create some issues for you in terms of what your general manager is able to do.
Final question for today, Kirk. As a prediction, and we'll ask you many times before the draft, if you had to pick the guy that the Oilers were going to choose number one, and we're in Vegas and we're putting down a little bit of money, who'd you bet on?
Wow. Well, I mean, we're looking at center or defenseman, right? But you know, and yep. Here I am. I'm talking about need as opposed to BPA. At the end of the day, I think you look at what Adam Larson has done, even though he's been hurt and hasn't played much. I think he is just one of these guys that, you know, given what he's capable of, and given his body of work to date, and how he really came on as a younger player, I think he's the guy they'll go with. And you know, he's going to be both. I think in Edmonton's mind, he would be not only the best player available, but he would be an obvious kind of needs-based pick. And he's someone that, given that he's competed in the Swedish Elite League for the past several years, would be ready to come and maybe do that right away, given the extensive experience he's had playing against men.
Kirk Ludyk, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having me, as always. And, you know, good luck the rest of the way. Hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, yeah, don't worry. We'll be calling you. Thanks, Kirk. It's 1:40 on Team 1260 Radio, Nation Radio. This is Alan Mitchell. Montreal up 3-0 on Pittsburgh, and I don't know what's going on. It looks like Pittsburgh is taking their frustration out on Subban, who's a lightning rod player. It's kind of a strange game. About 2.5 minutes left in the second period, and there's been a few fights. Mara on, I think, Talbot, and some action going on in that hockey game, and we'll keep you updated on that. Coming up, looking forward to this, Oklahoma City's play-by-play announcer for the Barons, Jim Beyer. There's lots of information that we don't know about Oklahoma City and their playoff chances, and an opportunity to get an update on some of those great prospects down in OKC. That's all coming up next.
Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Okay, we've got a few emails we can zip through here. 1:43, 17 minutes before 2 o'clock on Team 1260. We are, of course, Nation Radio, live at the Pint this afternoon, 109th and Jasper. Don't forget the Pint having their opening of their new Pint on Yeah, on White Avenue on St. Patty's Day. So that's just coming around the corner. This is from Summit talking about the Chara hit. Many people are criticizing the league for not suspending Chara. However, Bruins are my second favorite team after the Oilers, so I may be a bit biased. I don't think it was a suspendable hit and the huge issue because of two factors. Pacioretty got injured and he's a Hab. Last game, Doughty got a similar hit from Umbarger. I'm not sure who, but he came back and played. So no calls from no one pulling sponsorship and no police investigation. Well, I think Summit, that, you know, we're close to an election year, right? And sometimes things get a little wonky in Canada or the U.S., and politicians jump in and some things are said, and that's happened in the past, and it'll happen again. The Chara hit, as I saw it, was, I think they call it right on the ice, get him off the ice, number one. Pacioretty was hurt, and it's unfortunate, but at least part of the blame, I think, has to go to the design of the building or every building, if the stanchion is part of it. It happened to Ryan Smith a few years ago, I remember. I don't recall a suspension on that, but it was definitely a play that Smith was injured in, and it was pretty frightening. So nothing happened after that one. Hopefully some safety measures are taken after this one, the Pacioretty hit, courtesy of Zdeno Chara. This is from MSG. When is Lowe going to get rid of Hemsky? Well, you know, it's probably coming. You know, I think that Alex Hemsky is at a point in terms of age. He was drafted in 2001, so he's about, what, 27 this summer? The Edmonton Oilers rebuild. The Dustin Penner trade means their rebuild starts with the Taylor Hall pick, I believe. So in the next probably, I would say, year or so, the Oilers are going to be the Taylor Hall Oilers as opposed to the Alex Hemsky Oilers or the Sam Gagner Oilers. And Hemsky has to be re-signed this summer. They may come to him with a contract. And if he doesn't sign it, then it's likely that we're going to be looking at Alex Hemsky leaving maybe as early as the draft. Okay. We have on the line with us from the Oklahoma City Barons play-by-play announcer Jim Beyer. Jim, how are you?
How Jim? You doing today?
Yeah, I'm very well, Jim. My first question for you, and I it's a math question, and I apologize, but I have been trying to figure out in a way that takes 10 minutes or less to explain the Oklahoma City Barons' playoff chances. Can you help me with that?
Sure. You know, it is a little complicated because in the American Hockey League, the way it is right now, there are 15 teams in each conference. And eight teams will make the playoffs out of each conference. And in the Barons situation, we're in the Western Division. There's eight teams in our division. There's seven teams in the other division in our conference. And theoretically, four teams from each division make the playoffs. But if the fifth-place team in our division, which has more clubs, has a better record than the fourth-place team in the Northern Division, then our fifth-place team will make it.
Okay.
And that's the crossover system. So when you see where the Barons are in the standings, you know, the number to look at really right now is fifth place because
okay.
It's likely, although not guaranteed, that the fifth place club in the Barons division will make the playoffs at the expense of the fourth place team in the other one. But not etched in stone, and those North Division clubs are getting a little better. So, you know, it's really almost too far away to, you know, get an accurate percentage prediction, let's say, who might make the playoffs out of the North and then the West Division because everybody is just so close.
And the Oilers keep trying to send you help, but the injuries keep popping up. I think Giroux was on his way down before the Gagner injury, but they had to keep him up.
Yeah, that was a situation that was great for Giroux. He's had another good year, and you know he's a real true goal scorer and a guy that is very popular with his teammates. Certainly would have helped our playoff chances if he had been able to stay down here, but that's not really what we're here for, obviously, and we like to see guys go up. But, you know, the injury that kept Giroux up there is certainly poses a bigger challenge for Oklahoma City, which we had become a rather low-scoring team over the last month, even with Giroux, and it was a tougher sledding without him. But last night, six goals and an overtime win, so some young guys sort of took up the slack last night. So we'll see how things go here down the stretch with about a month to go.
Who are the heroes last night? I know Harda Kanen played well. Who else really helped the victory?
Well, a rookie out of Yale, an undrafted rookie named Mark Arcabello, who spent most of the year in the ECHL out in Stockton, he had two goals and assisted on the game winner in overtime, plus he had an assist. And Arcabello's a guy that was an extra forward for us, but he's started to play quite well. There's also a defenseman who spent most of the year in Stockton out of Boston College in his second year, Anthony Aiello, his first year at the AHL level, he had a three-point night as well. So those two guys, along with Timu, really stepped up. And it was a really good effort last night. This Grand Rapids club, which is Detroit's team, hasn't had many player moves this year. They haven't sent that many guys to the Red Wings, but the core AHL guys that they have are really quite good. So it proved to be a pretty interesting game, and the Barons have them again tonight.
Arcobello and Aiello, are they on AHL contracts, or are they Oiler kids?
Arcobello was on an AHL contract, so he was actually assigned by us to Stockton.
Okay.
Both of them were in camp with us. Aiello is technically on a professional tryout, as they say, at the AHL level. So he's not on an AHL deal. He's on a professional tryout contract. But Arcobello is on an AHL deal and was with us in camp, actually opened the season with us but didn't play. He was on the roster at the start of the year and then was loaned to Stockton and has been recalled back here to the AHL. He's been with the Barons now for probably going on about a month in this stint.
Okay. When the Dustin Penner trade came down, we're familiar with Colton Tubert, having seen him play in the Western League out here. Some of us felt he might have a little more offensive ability than he had maybe shown with Manchester. It looks as though he scored a couple of goals in five games down there, plus two. Looks like he's bringing a little more complete game to Oklahoma City.
Yes, he has. He was saying in an interview with us that he, you know, even with the wrist injury, he had always fashioned a really good shot, and he works on trying to get the shot through from the point, which, you know, in today's game, it's not always easy to get those shots through. And he did score in each of his first two games with the Barons. One of those was a tying goal with 17 seconds left last weekend against the Flames Club from Abbotsford. So that was a very timely goal. He's shown a rocket of a shot here, and he does have two goals and an assist already and has shown the kind of defensive grit that everybody thought he would have. But while he's not necessarily what you would call a guy that might see a lot of power play time at the next level, he has shown good instincts as to when to pinch, and he's shown a pretty good shot so far. So I think that he may end up showing a little bit more offense at this level, especially as he gets more comfortable than it looked like he would from the beginning.
Kevin Montgomery came over at the deadline from Colorado's organization for Sean Bell. What kind of player is he, and how has he looked so far?
You know, he's looked pretty good, too. He had a nice game last night. He had an assist, and Montgomery and Tubert are paired together. That was not their original plan, but when Alex Plott went up to the NHL, that kind of mixed up the pairings, and Tubert and Montgomery have adjusted quite well. Montgomery is not the physical force that Tubert is. He theoretically is a little bit more of a puck mover, I think, than Tubert. Might be a little bit faster skater, not as big a guy. Montgomery's just kind of one of those defensemen that he's sort of a jack-of-all-trades. He's a defensive guy by nature, but has enough skill to move the puck and maybe get a little odd power play time here and there. And he's a guy that only had a couple of goals, three goals, I think, with Lake Erie this year. A couple of them proved to be game winners. But you know, he's an American-born kid that played some for the U.S. national team in the World Junior Championships. So you know, he's a guy that's experienced the game at some high levels, and I think as a guy that could contribute down the line as sort of a guy that can fill a variety of roles back there on the blue line.
This is Nation Radio on Team 1260 Edmonton Sports Radio. We're live at the Pint. This is Alan Mitchell along with Jim Beyer from Oklahoma City, the Barons pay-by-pay announcer. Oilers signed a college man, Tyler Fadoon, about a week or so ago. Hasn't played yet. Is he down there, or is he practicing with the team, or?
He is, you know, if he's arrived today, I'm not sure. With this being the third game in three nights and all, I did not get to the building today. I don't know if they really even did anything this morning down there. Getting ready to head to the rink, actually, here in a little while. Fadoon was not in town yesterday. He's finishing up his schooling at Princeton, and he's about to hit spring break. So he is due to join us, if not today, then for a nine-game road trip that we have starting on Tuesday in Peoria. The situation with Fadoon is he's trying to finish up his senior project and finish up his degree at Princeton, and he's going to do that, and if he can play with the Barons in and around that, he might in this upcoming road trip. I don't know if he'll be here today. I haven't been able to verify that, but you know, he's a guy that if he plays, it'll probably be in just sort of a supplemental role. Right now, pretty much all the defensive spots are pretty much filled, but I think they'd like to take a look at him. So I think they're going to take him on the trip, whether he gets here today or joins us for the road trip. Either way, he'll probably debut with us here in the next week or so. And then he most likely will not be with us at the tail end of the regular season because he'll be going back to school.
A couple of quick ones here, Jim, before we leave you. Chris Vandevelde, he's a big centerman. He's a little older than most of these kid prospects who've turned pro last fall. How has his overall game looked?
You know, it's been pretty good of late. His stats are still a little off kilter. You know, he's got about 11 goals now on the year. He scored goals in two straight. Had a goal last night, a fairly important goal as well. Had a goal the night before. You know, he's his plus-minus is still a bit on the ugly side, but he fell behind early in that. It's been hard for him to get back to square in the plus-minus category. I think he's done a pretty nice job on that third or fourth line. You know, he hasn't always been paired with the type of line mates that are going to allow him to pick up a lot of assists along the way, so his assist total is a little lower than you think it might be for a centerman. But I think he's a guy that still has a chance down the road to see time at the higher levels. If you were right now just judging his season this year, I'd say it'd be kind of a mixture. There's been some good stretches, some other stretches where things haven't fared as well, but that's kind of been the way the whole team has been. By and large, it's been a positive year down here, but there have been a couple of stretches where things have been a little harder to come by. But I think he just needs a little bit more time at this level and maybe a little more experience in different situations, but he's been a solid penalty killer and has been a good draw man. He's been good on draws this year. And so, you know, I think he's still somebody worth hanging on to and giving another look next fall in NHL camp and then maybe another tour through the AHL. You know, he just kind of gets used to the pro game after being in college in North Dakota.
Jim, thanks so much for your time. It's really appreciated.
Hey, no problem. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
All right. Jim Byer, play-by-play man from the Oklahoma City Barons. And you can listen online, by the way, if you go to the AHL.com. They can put you right through and listen to him. He's a very good play-by-play man, and that's an interesting team. Coming up next week, we'll be definitely talking to E.J. McGuire, I promise, and we'll also have Jonathan Willis back. This is Nation Radio every Saturday between noon and 2 on Team 1260 Radio. Coming up next, we've got Live at Gretzky's, and don't forget to tune in later on this afternoon to Jeff Cashel's terrific show. Thanks very much.